Scott, I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the latest installment in our new regular, The Ranking, a cross-platform extravaganza that bestrides both Empire Magazine and the Empire Podcast like a big old colossus. The premise is very, very simple. Every month, four Empire writers get together and argue the toss about a series or a particular filmmaker with one goal, coming up with a definitive top 10. This month, in Meeting Room 5C, we are chatting about the real king of New York, the man with the greatest eyebrows in show business, sorry, Noel Gallagher, the goodest of all fellas, Martin Marty Scorsese. And here to talk all things Marty with me over the next hour or so are three colleagues of such lethal cunning. Terry White.
Hello.
Hello. Ian Freer.
Hello.
And Dan Jolin.
Hiya.
How exciting. This is exciting, isn't it?
It is. I mean, you've kind of given away some of our secrets by letting on we're in Meeting Room 5C, the most glamorous of meeting
rooms. Well, I kind of wanted to explain away the slight difference in sound quality from normal Empire podcasts.
It was smooth.
It was smooth. I like the way I covered it up. And also, I can cut it out, so
yeah.
I don't have to say that.
Please leave this in.
I will leave this in. I'll leave all of this in.
All of it.
It's like
all
an interrogation room in here, actually. I could imagine sort of like a bad cop coming in and kicking a chair across it and glaring at me angrily.
People will glare at us angrily because we are surrounded by glass. People can watch us pontificate and argue over the next hour or so. You should have been here for the Stephen King thing. It was boiling in here.
Really?
Yeah, we were down to our underoos by the end of it.
Oh, God.
Ooh. Yeah, but I've had to turn the heat down. Don't worry, it's all good. It's all good. So we're going to be talking about Martin Scorsese in this one. Let's start off with a nice, very, very simple thing. He's pretty good, isn't he? He's all right.
Yeah. If you're into that kind of thing.
If you like good films.
If you like amazing films.
If you like good films. What was your introduction to Scorsese? When did Marty Scorsese? I'm going to call him Marty all the way through. I've met him once. I'm entitled. When did we first meet Marty Scorsese? When did we first bring him into our lives?
I first met Martin Scorsese. I love Steven Spielberg and George Lucas, and they were movie brats, and he was one of the movie brats. So I was reading about him. And my dad, I was 13 years old, and my dad put me in an overcoat and took me to see Raging Bull to try to get me in at the ABC Holloway Road. It didn't happen, but we tried again and again and again, and eventually I saw it. So, yeah, I'm an early adopter, well, a relatively early adopter of Martin Scorsese.
Okay, so can you remember the first one you actually got to see?
Yeah, Mean Streets would have been on video.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mean Streets, that's a good start. Terry?
Well, so no hiding in overcoats trying to get into the cinema. Actually, I only did that once for The Delinquents.
Okay.
And I was only a year younger, this is totally irrelevant, but I had a massive perm done because I thought a perm would make me look older. And I got in to see The Delinquents
wow.
at 10.
Delinquents and Scorsese, that's the first time they've ever been mentioned in the same conversation.
So I got into Scorsese via my brother, which is actually how I got into most violent films. I think I've spoken on the podcast before about my love of violent movies. And actually, Goodfellas was the one I first saw. Actually, weirdly, close followed by Cape Fear. And I have a big love of mobster movies and mafia movies. And Goodfellas as well, the soundtrack. Completely hooked me in. I'm a big fan of girl groups, of that kind of era, 60s, 70s music. So I fell in love with so many things about that film, and I will tell you them in great detail when we go on to that. But that was that was my introduction. I think when I saw Goodfellas, I must have been 9.
Okay. All right. And then blew your socks off.
Absolutely blew my socks off.
Danforth.
Well, my first Scorsese movie in the cinema was Cape Fear.
Did you sit in front of people smoking a cigar and laughing loudly at everything that happened?
Yep, and I went home underneath the car. I wasn't really massively aware of him at the time. I don't think I was yet fully formed enough as a film lover to really be following directors as such. I just thought the film looked quite cool and went to see it, and didn't actually enjoy it that much. Weirdly enough, I found it quite. The styling of it I found too overblown.
Have you revisited?
Melodramatic. I've seen it since, and I'm not in love. I'm not in love with it. I'm not in love with that film, I have to say. But really, the one that made me fall in love with him as a filmmaker was Goodfellas. Duh. I remember all those Goodfellas adverts in the Marvel comics. Do you remember? There was loads of Goodfellas ads in the Marvel comics when I was reading them.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah. Goodfellas was all over Marvel.
Are you talking
Marvel
about the pizza?
Comics. No, definitely the film. Definitely.
Are you sure about that?
Well, maybe my mind's sort of like converging two different things in a weird way. But that's what my memory's telling me now, right
okay.
now.
Okay. But you're not, say, maybe confusing Marvel Comics with Empire Magazine, which came out a year before Goodfellas.
Mm.
And was certainly instrumental in introducing me to Marty.
No. Maybe it was DC Vertigo titles, because they were for mature readers.
Yeah, I wouldn't have imagined that.
Yeah, I think it was
advertised
DC,
an R-rated Vertigo film.
But then I didn't see it for a bit after that.
Okay.
So Chris, you got into it through Empire, did you?
I think I got into Scorsese for Empire, but my first memory of a Scorsese film is seeing the trailer for After Hours attached to a VHS copy of something, so probably Terminator or Aliens or something like that, and just being, oh, I want to see that film. Yeah, so I think I saw Scorsese films before I was aware of Scorsese.
Yeah.
So, you know, growing up as a film fan, you're aware of Taxi Driver.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure that I was aware of Scorsese in the way that I was aware of, you know, Zemeckis and Spielberg when I was growing up. So I think I saw After Hours and The Color of Money before I knew who Martin Scorsese was.
Right.
So probably the first Scorsese film that I saw knowing who Scorsese was, it probably was Goodfellas. Because it was in that sort of sweet spot, and I had parents who were really, really laissez-faire with what I watched, and so they didn't mind that I was, you know, 13 or 14 when it came out in VHS. I just rented it and watched it. So it probably would have been that. And then from there, I have very, very strong memories of watching Taxi Driver for the first time and thinking, you know what, this guy's pretty good. Hey, for me, he seems to be the filmmaker's filmmaker. Does that seem fair? He seems to be, if you asked most directors, I would say, especially, you know, to canvas living directors, to their favorite living directors, I would imagine that most, if you asked Spielberg or Jackson or Edgar Wright, who were the real influences on them, you know, it would be Scorsese.
Yeah, it's Spielberg, maybe not, because they're kind of contemporaries. But
yeah, of course, yeah. I think but I mean, not influences in terms of Spielberg, but certainly who's the greatest living filmmaker. I think if Spielberg could recuse himself in that conversation, he would say Marty Scorsese.
Yeah, I think most directors would say that.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Paul Thomas Anderson, Quentin Tarantino. I'm just thinking of, you know, great, great younger filmmakers that you probably wouldn't have if it hadn't been for Scorsese.
Yeah.
I think it still influences filmmakers today. I think he's arguably as relevant to young emerging filmmakers as to the generation you're talking about.
Yeah,
as well.
Ben Wheatley. Yeah. And yeah. Yeah, mm.
Do we think that he's still producing work that's on a par with his best work? Do we think he's in his 70s now? Do we think he's still as vital and as driven as he was? I mean, recently he's made The Wolf of Wall Street and Silence, and he's making a film at the moment that I, it's the film I'm most excited about this year that doesn't have a cape in it, and it's The Irishman, which is, you know, De Niro and Pacino and Joe Pesci and the big one, Bobby Cannavale. We're all excited about that. And I can't wait for Scorsese to return to his roots and make a movie with De Niro again, because that's the partnership. It's like, you know, that's another thing that I grew up with. I was really obsessed with partnerships. I was really obsessed with Carpenter and Russell and Raimi and Campbell and, you know, people like that. And so the idea that, you know, here was this actor and director who worked together, what, 6-7 times in a row, made some amazing, amazing films together. I was really excited by that. And so they haven't worked together since Casino. And so I'm fascinated to see how they slip back into it. You know, I've enjoyed the films that Scorsese has made with Leo DiCaprio, but for me, they're not a patch on anything he made with De Niro, necessarily.
No, and that would be the same with his recent output versus the 70s and 80s output. You're comparing them against the greatest films of the past 40 years, aren't you?
Taxi Driver, Raging Bull.
Mean Streets, it's so hard to do that. So I think it's an unfair comparison to put Wolf of Wall Street. You know, you're better to put how does Wolf of Wall Street compare to what was out that year?
Yeah.
It's pretty much better than anything that year.
Well, it's funny because when I was looking at the top 10, Wolf of Wall Street is definitely in there, but I mean, we've talked about this on the podcast before. Silence, I didn't particularly love.
Uh-huh.
But I loved Wolf of Wall Street, and that felt for me in, I know what you're saying about comparing kind of apples and oranges, but by the same token, it felt like in the same vein as all those Scorsese films I'd love the most, and felt I could see a thread from Casino, for example, and from Goodfellas through to Wolf of Wall Street. Mm. But since then, and as you say, The Irishman is the thing that, and you have to hope with those partnerships back. And what do those partnerships look like now? What does the partnership with De Niro look like now? De Niro hasn't necessarily spent the last few years making his greatest work, if I can say that.
Have you seen The Intern?
Yeah. I was talking to somebody about The Intern the other night, and I'm like, what? My main question is why, and my secondary question is why.
It's genuinely good.
Oh my God, no.
It's a Nancy Meyers film I like. No. I don't understand.
So I'm really excited. I'm really excited by that because I think as much as Scorsese, what that brings to De Niro at this point in his career is really exciting.
Hopefully someone who will challenge De Niro.
Yes.
Because I think De Niro, the odd film aside and the odd director collaboration aside over the last 10, 15 years, and he probably would even admit it himself, you know, he probably doesn't put in the hard yards for Dirty Grandpa, but he will put in the hard yards for The Irishman.
Yeah.
Also, it's Scorsese returning to that milieu, isn't it? That kind of going back to gangsters and crime, and that's always exciting, isn't it?
And what does that look like in modern? Because that's what I loved about Wolf of Wall Street. That didn't feel like an older generation filmmaker trying to make a film. Because even though, obviously, it wasn't set today, it kind of felt like a thoroughly modern film. And I think that's what's exciting, is what does that world look like through Scorsese's gaze now compared to the 70s?
Now, I thought Wolf of Wall Street was astonishing. I mean, it was as exciting as anything being made by any, you know, exciting upcoming filmmaker at the time. Yeah. And it's funny, actually, because I've done my 10 and done it quite instinctively with lots of scribbling out.
Yeah,
but half of it is films he's made since 2000.
Wolf of Wall Street.
Since 2000. So since the start of the century.
Really?
Yeah, five films since the start of the century.
Okay, so let's see. So you have... Don't tell me you got Hugo in there. Do you have Hugo in there?
No. I liked Hugo. It was sweet. No, it didn't. Massively impress me.
It's how I got to meet Martin Scorsese, because I hosted a press conference for that. So I have a soft spot for Hugo, which is why it's number 11 in my top 10. But it is. It's a director trying to explore new tricks and do new things and trying to hook up with this new funky technology that the young kids are all talking about. But I'm not so sure that, you know, I would have thought that a 3D movie from Scorsese might have been more of an event. It might have felt more vital in a way, and it didn't really for me.
Well, I just thought it's a film about the kind of the birth of cinema and the love of cinema. I didn't really feel that from it much.
Yeah.
It didn't really work for me, Hugo.
Okay, but since 2002, so what else is on there, Dan? Don't give away your entire top 10.
I'm not going to give away my entire top 10. But obviously, The Wolf of Wall Street, we just said.
Yeah. Silence is on there?
I actually really love Silence.
Okay.
And it's really sort of stayed with me, a lot of the imagery in it. And I just, I thought I could understand why a lot of people didn't like it, because it's quite hard work as a film. But sometimes I like a film that's hard work. Oh. And I thought Garfield was absolutely superb. And I thought, as an exploration of something which has pretty much been in all of his work, but he's never sort of dived that deep, I think, in terms of really, I mean, Ian, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm feeling that I don't think he's ever really gone so deep in terms of exploring faith and the challenges of faith.
And almost the
compromise, the spiritual compromise that you make when you commit yourself to, you know, an ideology so firmly, just if that kind of makes sense.
It's that and obviously Last Temptation of Christ are the films that deal most with the idea of how can you be a human being and have a spiritual life,
which is
what a rough thread that runs through all the films pretty much.
It's not as good as The Last Temptation of Christ, which is higher up on my list, but yeah. I found it profoundly involving, actually.
So this idea of spirituality and this idea of faith being important and Catholicism being important to people as well, Kundun aside, obviously, does run through his work. It's right there from the off in Mean Streets. You have, you know,
his very first film, Who's That Knocking at My Door, which is a kind of dry run for Mean Streets, is that story about a guy choosing between the girl and faith and that kind of thing. So I think, you know, it is the kind of the key theme if you want to get to grips with Scorsese.
You think that's the key theme?
Yeah.
For me, where it intersects with the kind of reality of life is where I enjoy it. So in things like Mean Streets, Silence, I just found it incredibly hard work. And I'm kind of have no problem with admitting that I prefer the much more kind of overtly aggressive, the very kind of action, not action-y, but the...
yeah, kind of vital.
Yes, and, vital, just, and there's lots of, there's kind of lots of bloodshed, there's lots of, you know...
Swearing.
Exciting films, swear, that's kind of...
Pistol whipping.
Pistol whipping, but I did see Silence, and I know it was, you know, it was a big hit with most of Empire, and I found it incredibly hard work. And it's obviously the subject matter and the way he digs into it and starts to unpick it, and the exploration of it. I can see how that's all really interesting and how that fits in with his work. But I want a gun and somebody being shot.
And cool music.
Yeah, I want some cool music. Like, what's wrong with you guys?
Yes. Last Temptation of Christ.
Yeah.
Harvey Keitel as Judas. Come on. That's just genius. I love that. And also, I like the way that like Judas is like a hero in The Last Temptation of Christ.
Yeah.
Mm. He makes the point, right? Okay, you wouldn't have like Jesus being Jesus if Judas hadn't done what he did. He was the best of the disciples. He rocked. By giving him up, he enabled Jesus to, you know, become a martyr, to become, you know, the great symbol he is to so many religious Christian people, you know? Yeah. So, I mean, that was fantastic, I thought.
So, is Goodfellas the best one?
No.
Yes.
Yes.
This is about our age, isn't it, I think? About where we saw our first course.
Get with it, old man.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. For me, 1990, dude.
It's Boxcar Bertha for Ian.
Yes, obviously Boxcar Bertha. For me, it's Raging Bull, which I think is exactly the mixture of kind of seriousness and vitality and filmmaking brilliance and performances that I don't think he gets better than that.
Interesting. Can I just shock you? I like red wine. Raging Bull's just on my list, but I don't think it didn't connect with me the way that I thought it was going to.
Right.
So
you didn't try to get into it wearing an overcoat when you were 13, did you?
Yeah. That's the pivotal difference between all of us, I think.
I watched Raging Bull. Remember there was a thing in Empire a few years ago? I can't remember what it was called, but we did a feature where Empire writers wrote about the film that they had overlooked.
Yeah.
That somehow it slipped
My Secret
net.
Shame.
My Secret Shame, that's what it was called. Thank you, Dan. And mine was Raging Bull, because despite being a big Scorsese fan and a big De Niro fan, and indeed, as I said, a big Scorsese / De Niro fan, I'd always avoided Raging Bull, and I don't really know why. And then when I
black
watched
and white.
It... Black and white. No superheroes. Yeah. Not even a hint of a lightsaber. Yeah, for some reason it just didn't really appeal to me, and also I like my boxing movies with robots and Russians and people running up mountains and montages, and so I saw this movie and I admire it and I like it, and clearly it's important for Scorsese and feels of a piece with, you know, with Mean Streets and Casino, and not Casino but Goodfellas, and it feels very much of you know,
in that world.
Thematically in that world, but I still didn't love it, if I'm honest. But I put it down at my top 10, just at the very, very bottom.
Because my memory is when Goodfellas came out, it was seen as the flippant one, the kind of not the serious one. My first Scorsese film, as it were, is that kind of, it felt flippant. And then really Casino felt like a ripoff of Goodfellas.
Yeah, massive.
But even now, I think, both of those, their kind of critical reputation has improved massively, especially Casino, I think. People love Casino now.
Yeah, I love Casino. Yeah.
Well, I mean, Goodfellas is my number one and Raging Bull is my number two.
Okay.
And I know exactly what you mean about Raging Bull. So I've always admired Raging Bull. I actually read the memoir first, which is a fairly prosaic, and actually this is what I think is magnificent about the film. It's a fairly prosaic memoir of kind of a middleweight boxer of a certain age. And you know, it's a fairly typical boxing story in some respects. You've got the kind of ups and downs you'd expect from a boxer of that range, the stuff in his personal life. I think Joe Pesci is astonishing in Raging Bull. The naturalistic performance he gives and the kind of glimmers you see of what he then goes on to become. And my appreciation for Raging Bull has grown over the years. And it's probably in the last 10 years that I've really grown to absolutely love it. And I think also obviously there's the whole thing about what Scorsese was going through in his own life and the professional kind of ups and downs that he'd been through, and how this story came to be born, and how that, and you feel that, I certainly feel, and I know obviously all the stuff about divorcing the art from the artist, but I certainly feel that weight carried with the film. And I find it now incredibly emotional. I last saw it at the Pictures, I think 6 months ago.
At the pictures. In 1953.
And I just found it astonishingly moving. And then Goodfellas, for me, I mean, it's just, everything about that film is magnificent. And bizarrely, I interviewed Henry Hill before I... So I interviewed Henry Hill when I worked at a men's magazine that shall not be named. and I remember, because I'd obviously had this connection with Goodfellas since being a kid, just being so excited to talk to him.
Right.
And he was everything... All of the narration in the film is very close to, like, actually how he talks in real life. And that film is just so rich and so... I mean, my love of music and film, I think, has a lot to do with Goodfellas. When you think about Walking in the Sand and that playing when they're digging up Billy Bat's body, and the intelligent, constantly surprising use of music in certain dramatic scenes in Goodfellas, for me, is just absolute pure...
Yeah, Eric Clapton. Who uses
genius.
Eric Clapton like that?
Yeah. Absolute genius.
Scorsese's record collection must be off the charts.
Can you imagine?
His Spotify playlists must be insane.
Yeah.
If he has Spotify. I imagine he does. Yeah, he introduced you to new songs and new bands. And yeah, he's like the cool brother that you never had.
Yeah, it's so much fun, Goodfellas, as well.
The pace,
the pace
of that movie is remarkable. And I feel like now it's really kind of cool to be like, to kind of diss Goodfellas and to act like it's almost like the populist, easy Scorsese.
Who does that? Is it millennials? Do millennials do that?
It's probably millennials. Ugh. If you're listening, millennials, it's all your fault. but I just think it's a masterclass. And I mean, Ray Liotta, who it's never been more amazing.
Yeah, who was he? And who is he? But then...
But the scene when he's chasing the police helicopters, and that whole sequence is astonishing. And it is. Sometimes I wonder what the deal is with ITV4, because I swear to God, I turn it on and 85% of the time I turn on ITV4,
right,
Goodfellas is playing.
Have you just switched over my ITV2 with Hot Fuzz?
I do think it is the single film I've seen the most, the highest number of times.
Of Scorsese films or the film in your life?
Of films in my life.
Wow.
Yeah.
I've not seen it in years, actually. Actually, I had a conversation with Lucy, my wife, just the other day. She said, we need to see Goodfellas again soon. It's been years since we've seen Goodfellas, but it is that kind of regular one we come back to. There's Goodfellas, there's Miller's Crossing, there's The Good, the Bad and the Ugly. You know, these films which are just like, this is Spinal Tap, need to come back, watch that again. Yeah.
So how do we rate Casino then in relation to Goodfellas? Because you're right, at the time people went, oh, he's gone to the same well again.
I said that. Yeah. I said that, and I'm 100% that. I saw Casino. I've only ever seen it once.
It's amazing.
I watched it and was so disappointed by it that by the end of it, I was just like, that was, you know, because it had been talked up. I mean, people I knew had absolutely loved it. And I was just watched it and felt like I was watching a kind of less interesting Xerox, to use an Americanism, of Goodfellas. And then I think I said this in conversation to someone once, and they went on a long rant about why I was wrong. So she's like, no, you're just wrong. And after that rant, I kind of was a bit petulant and thought, well, screw you, I'm never seeing it again now. And I haven't.
Wow.
So there you go. That's all I've got to contribute to Casino. Sorry, everyone.
Yeah, I just think Sharon Stone gives it something really different as well. That's you know, this kind of macho world, and it's a really interesting portrayal of a woman, which is kind of rare for Scorsese. There's a few interesting ones, you know, Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, but really it's a male world. So to see her, I think really...
You've got that in Goodfellas, though, as well. Like when she takes over the voiceover and everything.
Kind of, but she feels a bit like a cartoon character.
Yeah, she's an archetype. I think you are bang on, because arguably De Niro and Pesci are playing very similar roles, right? But I completely agree that Sharon Stone is the difference. He gets... Scorsese is criticised a lot for his archetypal depictions of women, right? And she is the kind of shrill, jealous wife. And the narration very much speaks to that. Like, it doesn't feel to me like a credible narration. But Sharon Stone as Ginger, I mean, that depiction of kind of that pill-popping woman, I just thought he'd actually done something really interesting and believable with that female character. And as you say, pretty much apart from Alice, they're all from a male point of view. And even though this is obviously from a male point of view, I thought that actually you had a really complex, interesting, vital female character, which is what I love about Casino, and which is why it's number three on my list.
I remember something about Casino. The one thing about Casino I remember bugging me more than anything else was just the prevalence of voiceover, just the fact that it doesn't let up.
Everything's
show and tell. You know, it's just like you're having things explained to you that you could just watch. And it really bugged me. I just found it really intrusive and really got in the way of the enjoyment. Am I just crazy?
No, I like that. You're not alone in disliking Casino, but I like the idea of multiple narrators, like the way that Pesci and Stone just crash the movie at times. I don't think De Niro's playing the same character at all. I think that Ace Rothstein is a very, very different. He's more passive. The plot happens to him. He's a bit of a patsy in a way. Obviously, you could maybe say that, you know, Pesci's character, Nicky, is along the same lines as Tommy DeVito. Mm. Maybe, but I think he's trying to explore different things. And there's ideas about failure and success and maybe, you know, the way the American dream keeps imploding, which is something he keeps returning to, I think, and certainly in Wolf of Wall Street as well. Yeah. I love Casino. What's the movie on your list that might surprise people?
I have Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, which is, for me, and I am absolutely, my gender has everything to do with me choosing this film. I actually think you could argue that it's a feminist film. I think it's really notable by the fact it is from a woman's point of view, a woman who struggles because she essentially is a nonconformist and doesn't want to kind of yield to society's ways. And you could argue that that's actually about the outsider and kind of free spirits and nonconformists generally. But I remember feeling like I'd stumbled upon something really special and really different. And Scorsese spoke to me in a different way as a woman through this film. Because you can't get around the fact that some of his depictions of women, Wolf of Wall Street, right? They're kind of things with big boobs and long hair and vaginas. Spoiler. I think this
they have spoilers.
They have spoiler warnings all over them. But I think this. So Alice to me felt like I discovered another part of Scorsese that felt like it was kind of just for me, even though it clearly isn't. But
are you slightly disappointed that he hasn't really explored that part of himself again for what, 40 years now?
I mean, do you know what? I don't know if I need him to. I think we have to be thoughtful. I think all filmmakers, no matter kind of what generation they're from, have to be thoughtful regarding how they portray women on the screen at the moment. I think that's just a given. But I don't need him to tell women's stories. Mm. But I really enjoyed him telling this woman's story.
Okay, so Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore is a shock contender, Ian.
I've got a couple. My number six is New York, New York.
Okay.
Which, if people have never seen, it's kind of a miserable La La Land.
Much like New York.
It's so full of the love of movies. Yeah, it kind of plays with that in that, again, spoiler, the relationship doesn't kind of work out in the end.
Yeah,
and there was also that time when all those kind of 70s directors were getting their work dismissed for being egotistical and hubristic. And
this is 1941,
It's in that vein. But De Niro's brilliant in it. The form of it, the style is amazing. Honestly, it does knock La La Land into a cocked hat. It's stunning. So that's a weird one on my list. I'm not going for The Age of Innocence, which is 1993, is a kind of a beautiful, tragic kind of portrayal of a man who can't express himself. Daniel Day-Lewis, terrific.
Why is that one appeal to you? Because when Scorsese plays against type, for me, I'm not always sure he grabs my interest, which is why there's no Kundun or Silence or Age of Innocence on my list. Yeah. But then again, I'm a wham bam, thank you, man. Again, no Tony Stark in this movie. Why should I?
I just think it's ridiculously emotional, that film, without shouting about it. It's about a guy who's going against societal pressure to be a man, and it's, again, a kind of Scorsese theme. And the place it gets to in the end is so moving. And Winona Ryder is amazing. She plays his wife, who's this kind of ingenue and seemingly very lovely, but she's absolutely scheming. She's brilliant in it.
And it's had a certain critical reevaluation as well, Age of Innocence. I do remember when it came out, people weren't fawning over it. But again, over the years, it seems to me to become one of those movies that people kind of almost forget that Martin Scorsese directed. Obviously, now it's coming out on Blu-ray, the Criterion Collection. So you know, there's no greater honor, really, for a film. For the Rock and Armageddon to be joined by The Age of Innocence. What an honor for them. So, maybe it's now time for people to revisit that. 3 hours, isn't it? I remember it being 3 hours.
Yeah, just under 3 hours.
Just under that. Okay. So Age of Innocence. Dan, anything surprising on your list?
Well, we've already talked about Silence and The Last Temptation of Christ. King of Comedy is my number two.
Likewise with me.
Oh, really? Yeah. Okay. I don't know how surprising that is, but I mean,
my number five.
Oh, well, there you go. Yeah.
My number six.
By process of elimination, you can probably now guess what our top tens are.
Yeah.
But
I don't know. Is Shutter Island surprising to have on my list?
I would say so.
Because I thought that was great fun.
It's terrific.
It's great fun. It's Martin Scorsese's Inception. I really enjoyed that. And it's got Mark Ruffalo in it. And everything is better for having Mark Ruffalo in it.
Does he Hulk out?
No.
You have my curiosity. Now you do not have my attention.
Sorry.
No, I liked Shutter Island. I didn't think it would be worthy of top 10. But then again, I think, and I don't know whether this is purely guided by sentiment, I put After Hours on my top 10 as well, which I think is a really interesting film. But there was a time, I mean, he made After Hours and then he made Color of Money. I think The Color of Money was his next movie.
Yeah.
Then he makes Last Temptation of Christ, which is obviously a very, very personal movie they'd be wanting to make for ages. Color of Money seems to be a strange, almost the odd one out amongst those. It doesn't really seem on the surface of it. Obviously, it's a sequel to The Hustler. But it seems to me, you know, Scorsese is someone who, we talked about this a little bit, stylistically, he may be second to none. And Color of Money seemed to me to be a chance for him to A, work with Paul Newman, and B, show off.
Yeah.
Is that fair?
Yeah. I mean, also, I think before After Hours, Last Temptation collapsed.
Oh, did it?
Yes, he was going to make it before then. So he just did a couple of things to keep his hand in, as it were, to keep making films. And so that's why he kind of did those. And I think they're both great, I think, especially After Hours. It's so funny.
Yeah.
So funny.
Yeah.
It's interesting. We've got this far and we've not mentioned his Best Picture winner.
Just about to say that.
I was on the set of that.
You were?
I was.
Yeah.
He didn't talk to me, though. He was too busy, apparently. Apparently he's making a film. The Departed.
But that's, yes.
The Departed, yeah, yes. In case you weren't aware.
Yeah. It's really good fun, but it hasn't really stuck with me, I don't think.
I felt like it was something he could do in his sleep.
Yeah.
And that's why I don't think it's not on my list, and I don't think it kind of stuck with me, kind of like Ian was saying, because it felt like all the stuff he does, well, just like all the stuff he does, right? So there's nothing in it for me that kind of, there's no singularity about it that I was like, oh, that's the one that does that, and that sticks with me because of that, which everything else on my list, there's a big kind of moment or thing, or there's a reason.
Yeah.
I was struggling to find a reason that would be on there.
Okay.
I think it helps if you haven't seen Infernal Affairs.
Yeah.
Because I had seen Infernal Affairs, so it didn't kind of strike me as hard as it could have done. But I thought as a reinterpretation, it was superb. And also, it's like Ian was saying earlier, if anyone else had made The Departed, you know, you would be going, what an amazing film, though, what an achievement.
Yeah,
but because it's Scorsese, you're like, yeah, well, we've kind of been here before, haven't we, Marty? You know, so, all right, pretty good, but let's get something else.
Let's just write off that film that has DiCaprio, Damon, Jack Nicholson, Alec Baldwin, Mark Wahlberg, Martin Sheen,
Ray Winston,
Vera Farmiga, Ray Winston. Forget Ray Winston's in the film, for God's sake. Yeah.
No, I mean,
amazing cast.
Amazing cast. Best I've ever seen Wahlberg. I mean, absolutely fantastic.
Yeah,
and Matt Damon as a bad guy as well. Which
oh, spoiler alert! He's great. He's really great in that, Wahlberg. When he wants to be, again, I think it's a De Niro thing. Like, when he does the hard yards, he could be really good.
Yeah, yeah. And I'd love this is definitely a spoiler. I love Matt Damon's death scene in that film.
Yes,
that thing where he just goes, oh, come on, kind of. That's his kind of like. He just walks in the door. He's like, oh, really?
Yeah.
And I think I'd like to think that my last words would be something like that.
It's not dissimilar to the Goodfellas scene, right? Another spoiler.
Yeah.
Into the garage.
Yeah. Although,
and he goes, oh, and he doesn't even finish the sentence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Although it's one in the back of the head.
It's a bit more. I think with Pesci in that one, it's a bit more kind of like. There's more anger in it, but with Damon in Departed, it's just he's a bit more tired.
There's definitely a sense of, oh, shit.
Yeah, yeah, it's just like, all right, then.
Do you think people dismiss it because, yes, it won Best Picture, but do you think it was the sense that, oh, let's just give him an Oscar, rather than it necessarily being the Best Picture of that year? And I really like The Departed, and I can't remember what it was up against. I think it was up against There Will Be Blood and films like that. But was it a lifetime achievement Oscar rather than necessarily here's a Best Picture?
Yeah,
Oscar.
I think it probably was, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, but we haven't mentioned Taxi Driver.
Well, we mentioned it, but we haven't talked about it.
Yeah, let's talk about Taxi Driver.
Let's talk about Taxi Driver.
Yeah, it's so close to my life. You wouldn't believe how close Taxi Driver is.
I actually believe that.
The amount of women I've taken to pornography. look, it's cinema's best depiction of loneliness, isn't it? It's just amazing. And just stylistically, the end shot where he's kind of coming over the dead bodies, it's amazing.
Mm.
It's so good.
When did you see it? Do you remember seeing it?
I saw it as a teen, I think. I saw it when I was in my see as much Scorsese as I can period. And it's brilliant. And it stayed with me. It's something I will go back to regularly.
Okay.
I find it completely unwatchable. So I'm not saying it's a bad film, clearly, because that would be ridiculous. But I find it, because of exactly what you're saying, it's the most exquisite and painful depiction of loneliness. The nihilism, I find it hard to sit through the entire thing.
Interesting.
It's so bleak.
Yeah.
And
I think it has a weird comic energy in it. There's a scene where De Niro's talking to Peter Boyle, and Peter Boyle's talking rubbish, and De Niro's just listening to him. Yeah. And that's really funny. And there's lots of little funny little things like that.
It has Scorsese's darkest cameo, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's just a horrible scene.
Yeah, you see the woman in the window.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where do you stand on the end? Because, you know, obviously there's this great, spoiler alert, fuck it. There's this great debate about the end shot. Is Travis hallucinating? Is it all going to start again for him? Is he even okay at the end? Is the end real? Well, what's your take on that? After the shootout?
Yeah, I think it's real. I don't think it's a dream sequence. I don't think it's like that. But I like that, the ambiguity of it. The film's all about ambiguity, isn't it? It's about not giving any answers to anybody, not spoon-feeding anything. So I think it's a film that contains its own tensions within itself. And I think that's one of the things it's lasts so long.
Do you think it seems to me to make a really perfect double bill with King of Comedy.
Yes, it's absolutely, it's King of Comedy. Yeah.
Yeah. Both of which have contentious, is that real, is that fake endings as well.
Yeah, yeah. Which is brilliant. The King of Comedy is great.
Yeah. I mean, I prefer it to Taxi Driver.
Yeah.
You know, I think Pupkin is a more interesting character and a better performance from De Niro than Bickle. I honestly do. And I think Pupkin's scarier than Bickle. Mm. Because Bickle was very much a, Bickle became kind of cool, you know, he's an icon as a character, and feels very much enshrined in that time. I mean, especially in like the New York of that time as well. I mean, New York is not like that anymore for, you know, good and bad ways. But Pupkin sort of still feels like horribly like, there are lots of Pupkins out there, but they're all on like YouTube now.
Yeah, it feels more permanent now.
You know? Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And I also, as a study of obsession and fandom to the extreme as well.
Yeah,
it's really quite chilling, but also it does make me laugh. I mean, it's called King of Comedy. It's not necessarily a comedy, but it does make me laugh at times.
I think some of his jokes at the end are quite funny.
Yeah,
they're generally quite good. I mean, in sort
about
of Tim
his father's
Fine
alcohol
way.
Had 2% blood in it. that's a really good line.
Yeah, it's good stuff. If you went to the comedy store of an evening and you saw Rupert Pupkin doing some of the material, you wouldn't feel shortchanged. You'd be all right with that. But De Niro's great now.
Jerry Lewis is terrific. Sandra Bernhard is amazing.
I think it adds a real nuance to, you mentioned it earlier, in Scorsese's kind of how he digs into the male psyche and constructs of masculinity and within society and all of that. And it feels like less of an archetype than, say, Travis Bickle or what have you. But actually, it's maybe not. And actually, it's a different kind of male archetype, and it's a different examination of masculinity.
Oh, you probably had a dozen Twitter arguments with people just like Rupert Pupkin.
Oh, you have no idea.
One's a psychopath who expresses himself, you know, through violence. The other one's just someone who's entitled to a psychopathic degree.
It's one of Scorsese's most conventional films cinematically. It's shot a bit like a TV show in a way. There isn't a lot of the kind of camera movement and operatics that you kind of expect from him, and that's interesting as well, I think.
Did you know it's one of the reasons why it wasn't so well received at the time?
Yeah, I think you want grand fireworks from Scorsese, and it didn't really give it to you.
Okay, so we're going to bring this bad boy home. Has he made a bad film?
No, he's not made an uninteresting film. All the films have cores of interesting things in them. Is Boxcar Burfer a great film? No, it's not. Mm-hmm. But I think it has interesting things in it. So it's, for me, he hasn't made a bad film.
Okay, interesting. Very, very quickly, favourite Scorsese characters?
Travis Bickle is the one for me that absolutely stands out as a single character.
Okay. Any others? Or is that it?
All the films are great. Johnny Boy, the energy of Johnny Boy in Mean Streets is astonishing. He's just to see him dancing to Mickey's Monkey when he's supposed to get in a car and drive away with the Harvey Keitel. It's brilliant.
Mm. What about Charlie? You like Charlie?
Oh, Charlie's great. Yeah, well, everyone wants a cousin like Charlie. He's just great.
We haven't really talked about that shot in Mean Streets, have we? The really influential shot where you strap the camera. You strap the camera to Harvey Keitel?
Yeah, there's a kind of a brace, yeah.
Or is Keitel on a platform? I can't remember how he pulls that shot off, but either Keitel's standing on a platform next to the camera and the camera moves with him, or the camera's strapped to him.
Strapped the camera to his head.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of, it's on a brace and it's kind of strapped to.
Yeah, there's an IMAX camera, it's massive. It's
Yeah, and he's kind of struggling through a bar to a rubber biscuit, I think the song's called.
Yeah, such a good shot.
Yeah.
You see it replicated so often by people. It's in, it's in Age of Ultron, for God's sake.
Every Aronofsky film.
Yeah. And the Paul Hall fight is kind of replicate that kind of tracking shot is something that's come up again and again and again in his own career and in other people's films as well.
Let's talk about favourite shots quickly before we bring Dan in on characters. Copacabana shot, hasn't it?
Yes.
It's got to be Dan, hasn't it? It's got to be.
Yeah. Although topped by Paul Thomas Anderson in Boogie Nights.
No. Hell no.
I think you find it was top of Joss Whedon in Adventures Assembly.
Oh, okay. Yeah, of course. Sorry, I forgot. Yeah.
It's a great shot where they're on top of the thing and then it goes from Thor to Hulk. Anyway, it's an amazing shot. Dan, characters?
Rupert Pupkin, Tommy DeVito.
Yes.
And Judas. Judas rocks.
That's a joke, isn't it? Waiting to happen.
What about Jordan Belfort? Any love for Jordan Belfort? Any love for the Quaalude sequence?
No, I don't actually. I mean, I hate that character. He's a horrific human being. I mean, you know.
Ironic love for Jordan Belfort.
I love the film.
Yes.
Oh, are you being ironic?
Yes.
Or am I supposed to love
him? He's an awful character.
I'm confused. Yeah. It's too much irony these days.
Yeah, sorry about
that. It's very confusing.
Too much irony in your diet. Terry?
So Tommy too, but also, and we haven't talked about this apart from you saying you hate it. I think you said you hate it. Max KD, so Cape Fear is in my top 10 and I absolutely love Cape Fear. And I know what you're saying, but I love how pulpy it is. That's right up.
Yeah. No, the thing is with Cape Fear, it's not a question of hate. It's more a question of I didn't gel with the style of it at the time I saw it. And I've seen it since and I still find it a little bit distancing.
Yeah,
I don't hate it by any stretch, though.
I found that character so compelling and pure. I'll tell you what, that character invokes more fear and terror in me than most other cinematic kind of bad guys I can think of. And the scene with Laurie Davis where she takes him back to her flat and he basically bites her part of her face off.
Yeah.
Is that I remember seeing that and that absolutely floored me. And I find that scene really hard to watch actually. But I just think, you know, the whole cigar thing, the weird Hawaiian shirts.
Yeah, also he's very smart, Max Cady.
Really smart.
Yeah.
And the kind of psychological, the pairing of a psychological with somebody with that physicality who is only interested in torture, essentially, through various different guises, emotional, psychological, obviously how he uses Juliette Lewis's character, all of that. I find that character really memorable and he, for me, makes Cape Fear one of my favourite Scorsese films.
Interesting. See, Tommy DeVito is an interesting one as well because you brought him up as a favourite Scorsese character, and certainly I think he's one of the most indelible Scorsese characters. But I don't like him. It's a bit like you with Jordan Belfort, or everyone with Jordan Belfort. You don't like him. I knew people like Tommy DeVito growing up. The people that
that's why it's so good. That's
the
why
hair
it's a trigger good
temper that you cannot. You know what am I? And then he suddenly just goes off on one.
Bullies.
And that scene with Spider. Is just extraordinary. I mean, it's an extraordinary piece of acting and a well-deserved Oscar for little Joe Pesci. Although he should have got one for Lethal Weapon 3 as well, let's be honest. So good.
It's a great injustice.
It's a great injustice.
They fuck you at the Oscars.
There's always the Golden Globes, always the Golden Globes. And of course, and there's also the Empire Awards as well. Do not forget. They right the wrongs of cinema. Very, very quickly, moment. Greatest moment in a Scorsese film. I'm only going to take one. I'm only going to take one from each of you. Ian.
Oh, God. the opening credits of Raging Bull.
Okay. Why?
Which is Robert De Niro dancing around the ring to Cavaliera Rusticana, and it's pure poetry.
Okay. Terry.
For me, it's Mean Streets, and it's De Niro's entrance with the two women.
Okay.
And the camera obviously freezes on Keitel, and you kind of have the music come in, and that kind of shot for me, particularly De Niro's entrance.
I'm going to change mine to that. Jumping Jack Flash.
The
cutting
than,
to Jumping Jack Flash is amazing. Yeah.
All right, Dan.
God, this is hard.
You can pick something from Shark Tale. It's fine. I won't tell.
I'm just going to be really, really boring. And actually, it's the Copacabana scene. I know I was joked about Paul Thomas Anderson topping it, but I hadn't really seen anything like that before. Like, seen, you know, at that stage when I saw Goodfellas, I hadn't seen a camera do that, or I hadn't seen, a scene built that way. Mm. And also, it kind of gets you to the, you know, to the heart of the character and to the appeal of being a gangster, as far back as he remembered, Chris. He always wanted to be.
I might go with the beginning of Casino. There's something about that. Great. There's something about De Niro getting into the car, turning on the car, and then going into that great credit sequence as well. That just really stays with me. I mean, there's so many great moments that you could choose. But yeah, Casino is such a... That's how you start a film, people. And that's how you end a podcast as well. Because that is it. That's it.
Okay.
Enough squabbling. Let's vote. That's it for our Martin Scorsese ranking podcast. If you want to know how our voting goes, how our top 10s all come together, and what the top 10 finally is, pick up the April 2018 issue of Empire, which is on sale now at all good and evil newsagents. Thank you so much for listening. Of course, it is goodbye from Terry.
Goodbye.
It's goodbye from Ian.
You're a mook.
It's goodbye from Dan.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off home to fetch my fucking shine box. See you next time. Thanks. Bye.